You've reached Hotel Pacifico, your five-star destination for BC Politicos. Press 4 for room service. Press the star key for your hosts, Mike McDonald and Kate Hammer.
Welcome back, guests. Good to see you, Mike and Jeff.
Good to see you.
Okay. Hey, Kate. We are all here to check in our latest guest, who's going to help us do a deep dive on the federal and provincial budgets and the view of BC from Ottawa. Later in the strategy seat, we'll talk about some of the legislative business the government is looking to get done before the end of session, what happened to Bill 12 and public health accountability, the prospect of a hidden crime tax, and we'll explore why John Rustad can't stop talking about vaccines. But first, we've got a guest to check in. The Honorable James Moore is here today at the hotel. He was elected to Parliament at the tender age of 24. He served as MP for Port Moody, Coquitlam, Port Coquitlam from 2000 to 2015, and is a former Minister of Canadian Heritage and Official Languages, Secretary of State for the Asia-Pacific Gateway, and Minister for the 2010 Olympics under Prime Minister Stephen Harper. He went on to become Chancellor at the University of Northern British Columbia and is now a Senior Business Advisor at Dentons. Welcome to Hotel Pacifico, James Moore.
It's a real pleasure to be here, and congratulations on the success you're having and growing the show, growing the channel. It's been a long time coming for people to have long-form discussions about BC politics, federal politics from a BC lens, so I'm really glad to be with you guys.
I'm feeling like that's we're the Hotel Tri-Cities these days.
No, I love it. Yes.
Well, it's the nexus of swing ridings, federally and provincially. It's kind of the new Kamloops, right? It's the there's a lot going on here. It's growing. You know, it used to be one Tri-Cities riding when I was first elected in the year 2000. Now it's two and a half coming. And provincially, it was usually two. And then POCO was always kind of NDP. Then it was three. Now it's four, five, if you bleed in Burr-Quitlam a little bit. And it's very swing. All three parties are competitive, either provincially or federally, with different percentages, depending on the popularity of things. So there's a lot going on here.
And you're on the Coquitlam side of the Tri-Cities.
I'm on the Port Moody side. So
you're in Port Moody. Okay.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So it's bisected perfectly by Lougheed Highway right through. So, you know, old Coquitlam, Millardville, with the largest Francophone settlement rests west of the Red River historically. You know, it's working class, the old mill town, but now it's, you know, growing middle class. Yeah. And then sort of the further north you go, it becomes, homes that have been around for a long time, people who are asset wealthy, and now increasingly people who are cash wealthy, who are buying into the neighborhood kind of 20 years, 30 years after it was established. So
I'm just thinking about the geography out there and thinking about the provincial map, that Westwood Plateau seat, or whatever it was called over the years, it was Port Moody Westwood, I think it was something else, Coquitlam Burke Mountain maybe.
Yeah.
But I viewed that as a safe seat for the forces of freedom and liberty on the center right.
And justice.
And justice. But it's now flipped NDP. It just shows you how much things moved orange over the last couple elections out there. Because, I mean, that should have been the last bastion of, free enterprise foothold in the Tri-Cities there. And it, that just shows how they lost a grip on it out there in the suburbs.
Yeah, but there's a lot of diversity here in a lot of ways, right? Like genuine diversity. There's like the housing mix here is really quite something, right? You have one-bedroom condos down around Coquitlam Center. You have, large 5,000, 6,000 square foot houses at the top of the plateau. Ethnic diversity, like
the Chinese population. Yeah.
Large Chinese population, about 20%, then Korean. The Persian community is growing on the plateau, and also a lot of broad income distribution, right? The largest employer in all of the Tri-Cities is the school district. Second the largest private sector employer is probably Costco, the rail yard. So then after that, you have a free fall into small businesses. So it's a real sort of a mix of suburbia and lots of ethnic and income diversity. And that creates that cascades into the politics and the political diversity that you have. So you have people like me representing it federally, Finn Donnelly, Christy Clark, in the area as well, Mike Farnworth, Brad West, Lou Sikora back in the day. It's like that's a pretty broad spectrum of left, right, and personalities, right? And so it's reflective of the people.
And you ended Lou Sikora's career, as I recall.
Well, yes,
his federal career, anyways.
Well,
his
no, MP career. Yes, federally, yes, but he returned back to municipal politics and, sustained.
He was a character.
Lou had a very interesting formula about politics, right? Like he, I remember, I think it was Richard Stewart who said it once, or maybe it was Finn Donnelly. He said it was always like, city councils, we have kind of the open discussion period, or a city council would come to a consensus about something. And, there would be, but there's, there's a 5% opinion that's outside. And Lou sort of collect, like, people would come to council and they would say, I want the city to study chemtrails because I think there's something to do with the chemtrails. It's affecting the quality of life of the people in the Tri-Cities. And council would say, we're not going to devote resources to that. But Lou Sikora would be the one vote who says, no, I think we should listen to the people. And so he accumulated this sort of motley coalition of people who had just, and Lou Sikora was the only guy who would listen to me, who understood that I wanted to know, why does it have to be two lanes or four lanes? We should just have three with alternating right through the suburb. And people say that's crazy, but Lou Sikora was the one guy who heard my opinion, and he just sort of collected this. And so you would go into a municipal Lou Sikora campaign office when he was running for mayor or city council, and it was people who have nothing in common except Lou Sikora was the one guy who always listened to me in my one issue. And it sustained him for a very long time. He had
Yeah.
this weird populist instinct about looking for people who were anxious or had an energy about something that nobody else was listening to, and he would corral them all together and was mayor for 20 years for that.
Made it work, yeah.
Yeah.
So you were, oh, go ahead, Kate.
I was going to move us forward if that's okay. Did you want to spend some more time in the past? Sorry, this is the dynamic, James. Like, I'm always like, what's next? And like, Mike will take you down memory lane.
Harsh.
Yeah.
And Jeff too. Jeff too. You also live on memory lane, Jeff. So let's spend some more time there.
No, I'm very forward looking. I reject that description.
We'll get on with the future then, Kate.
Okay, then on with the
Yeah.
future. We may journey back. We may journey back. But I because I wanted to ask James, I think you set us up nicely, because I'm curious, we're talking sort of in the wake of the federal budget, a few weeks out from the provincial budget. Is there anything that you saw out of either of those budgets that people in Port Moody, Port Coquitlam, that are stuck with them, or they might still be talking about?
Well, as we talk now, we have, I mean, I can speculate, but we do have some public opinion research and some data about this, right? That they were both effectively non-events. Neither of them moved the needles effectively for either the federal or provincial government. The federal government needed a needle shaker more than the provincial government does, even though I think Premier Eby's numbers are incredibly soft, and we can talk about that in a minute. But federally, it's absolutely conclusive for anybody who is doubting the conclusivity of the argument that the Liberal Party of Canada has completely vacated the ideological free enterprise center ground that was previously occupied by Prime Ministers Martin and John Manley and others, right? You have spending growth 7% increase based on an assumed economic growth of 1% that is based on a 3% population growth that is juicing up the 1% artificially. Per capita GDP is going down, and we just have just this endless appetite for spending on the federal side to keep the NDP Liberal coalition moving forward in ways that are utterly unsustainable, with frankly well-intentioned but half-baked plans, whether it's dental care or child care or other things that are all, have large broad public sympathy but are completely half thought through. And so you have a government that is, I think, lost all credibility when it comes to being prudent and reasonable fiscal managers, which obviously opens up the ground for Pierre Poilievre to step through with a credible plan, sort of beyond just simply focusing on the carbon tax, but to talk about fiscal rationality, given the increasing anxiety that the public has about the state of our finances.
So is it really kind of a state of our finances message that you think people are taking away more than maybe even what was invested in or not invested in this budget?
Well, I think we sort of had a generation of Canadians who were, because of their personal circumstance, like when interest rates, mortgage rates were at, you can get a mortgage rate for 1.8, 1.9, 2.2. That was kind of a standard mortgage rate that a lot of people could get for 15 or 20 years. And so people, and I think in their personal lives, assumed that debt, there's good debt and bad debt, and good debt, if you leverage it forward, is not necessarily a bad thing. Governments kind of operate in the same plane, but they even have more latitude to pile up debt because they can control money supply, and they have a longer view of things, and who doesn't buy bonds from governments? And so I'm not really worried about debt. And in fact, as we know, in the 2015 election campaign, when Tom Mulcair campaigned on a balanced budget, which was unique for a New Democrat, and Justin Trudeau emphasized that he was going to run deficits because he was so fed up with the lack of responsiveness of the Stephen Harper government to our social needs that he was prepared to do the tough thing, which is uniquely proactively run deficits to demonstrate how committed he was to tackling these challenges. And it had some political resonance to, I think, a lot of people's surprise. In retrospect, it kind of, you know, it's actually makes sense in some ways to the to that progressive audience that was thirsting for someone to sort of be genuinely committed to more social spending in the face of some austerity by Stephen Harper coming out of the 08 recession and going into 2015. But here we are now, 9 years later, and people have seen their mortgage rates go up and what it means to their bottom line. And there's almost been, I hate to sort of phrase it this way, but like almost kind of a re-rationalization or re-education or a reawakening of the broad public about the dynamics of finances, that compound interest matters, deficits and debts in your personal life matter. They matter to governments too, because that eventually comes back to you in terms of your tax burden and your obligations going forward. And so you see kind of the fiscal, you know, need for restraint emerging now as a growing issue, in spite of the fact that Pierre Poilievre talks more about axing the tax, less about balancing the budget. So I think there's some currency there politically that has not yet been tapped into. You can't overstate it, but I think there's among the reasons why we've seen this shift of young Canadians identifying more as conservatives than has ever been before the circumstance in our collective lifetimes is because like a lot of young Canadians are pretty anxious about the future in their personal circumstance, but in our collective circumstance as well. And they think that more spending is not always a better thing.
There's been a strong statement though from Pierre Poilievre that Canada is broken, and you were the Canadian Heritage Minister. And, you know, Mr. Poilievre talks about we'll axe the tax, we'll stop the crime. You know, those kinds of simple declarative statements. Is the Conservative campaign unfolding as kind of a back to the future sort of approach, or is there going to be a vision for Canada, which you would know as former Heritage Minister, is a tricky thing to articulate for Quebec on the one hand, BC on another, that kind of thing? Where do you think it'll all go in the debate?
I think his message had, I mean, there's been some slight iterations of it, right? When he says Canada is broken, I think the better way of saying it, in which, and I think he has said it this way, is to say it feels like Canada is broken. And I don't think that's an unreasonable statement to say when you look at the pessimism that's out there, particularly with younger Canadians, that it feels like can't buy a house. It feels like can't afford university. It feels like I can't get a job. It feels like it's not a good deal to stay in Canada. I think that's a reasonable statement to say that Canada is broken, I think, is an untrue statement, because otherwise, why do we have such record levels of in immigration and in migration into the country? So there's a slight duration there. But I think your broader point, though, and I think it's true to say, I've always been of the view that when you decouple optimism from conservatism, conservatism loses. That you have to provide a picture of the future that is aspirational, that is pro-growth, that is, you know, the harsh way that Margaret Thatcher would say it is, socialism requires capitalism to pay the bills. True. Better way of saying it, though, is that you about unleashing the human potential to pursue your dreams, find out what you're really good at, invest in that, find out what you love, and good results come from that, including growing incomes, growing prosperity, more freedom from fear of financial stress, which allows you choice in how you want to live your lives. It allows us collectively to move together through the commonwealth interest of the collective interest of working together through government and NGOs and voluntary organizations, and like the rising tide argument and all that. I think that optimistic message and tone of the free enterprise movement historically always has more purchase. I mean, Christy, I mean, keeping, you know, in the most contemporary example that people that you guys have, right? Like Christy Clark's campaign pivoted from, you know, Adrian Dix and kicking the dog and can't lose an election to Christy Clark winning. It wasn't that Adrian Dix was necessarily opposed to LNG or was necessarily opposed to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. It's that Christy Clark was for it. It was kind of a can-do thing. Like let's do something.
He did state his opposition to Kinder Morgan, which created that contrast, right?
Right. That created the contrast, and she stepped into that gap, which was the optimistic thing, right? So I was thinking. I remember John Furlong. It was a really impactful moment when he was campaigning for the referendum in Vancouver for the 2010 Olympics, and somebody stood up and said, you know, I've got a list here of 10 different. I'm going to go through them. I've got a list of 10 reasons why we shouldn't host the 2010 Olympics. And John Furlong, the person went through the list, and John Furlong goes, you have a list of 10 reasons why we shouldn't host the Olympics. I've got a list of 40 reasons why we shouldn't host the Olympics. We can probably make a list of 50 reasons why we shouldn't host the Olympics. The question isn't, can you make a list? The question is, can you tackle the list, and are you committed to making it happen? Because at the end of the day, we will have gone through those hoops and jumped those barriers and built something that will have lasting impact and consequence for this city. You can always find reasons not to do something. And I just think that that aspirational thing is something that draws more attention and more lasting political support. And so people will go, they'll stand with you through some of the tough decisions that you have to make in government, because when they bought into your program in the beginning, you had a vision that was better than what the status quo was had you not gotten elected. I think that has greater velocity and staying power.
So there were a lot of tributes recently to Brian Mulroney.
Yeah.
And there was, he was lauded for, you know, in hindsight, his vision on free trade and what he tried to do to bring Canada together, albeit unsuccessfully on the constitutional front. And so on and so forth. But today's Conservative Party is different. It's probably different than when you were elected 20 odd years ago, and different under Stephen Harper. I'm interested to know how, like, all parties evolve, but how do you see it today? It's different from the past. Is there a different character to it today? Like, is it a different nature of a coalition there than compared to decades ago?
I would say significantly more blue collar. Significant, yeah. And, you know, the cliche of boots, not suits, I think is very true. The, you know, every leader brings their own emphasis on the kind of coalition that they aspire to assemble. Brian Mulroney had a different dynamic. Also, the political map that Brian Mulroney was facing in 83, 84, as he went into those campaigns, and then 88, by focusing it to a ballot question on free trade, as opposed to just sort of a general referendum on his government, yeah, which probably wouldn't have gone very well, was smart politics. But, you know, but you look at the landscape in front of you and you accept reality on reality's terms about where your seats are. And the coalition that Brian Mulroney assembled in 84, you probably wouldn't try to replicate in 24, 25. But Pierre Poilievre looks at, I think, the landscape in front of him, and he's putting together a coalition that I think is broad-based, pan-Canadian, different, more blue-collar. And, you know, back in the days when I was with Preston Manning and the Reform Party, when I was first involved in politics, the idea of an NDP reform switch voter, federal provincial, you knew they were out there in the wild. They existed, but you didn't quite know them. But they were there because they couldn't not be there. Like, how do you win Nanaimo with 50% and then the NDP wins? They're there. Well, who are these? Now you can name them, and I know them. And so you go to a federal riding association, you'll find people who support Mike Farnworth, you'll find people who support, like, it's not an uncommon thing. More provincial New Democrat, federal conservative than has been in the past. But there's a comfort about, you know, being sort of just the regular guy. Whereas in the past, I think it was more corporatist, is more elitist, more elite accommodation and all that. And so Pierre, I think, has connected that sort of populist strain of the country in a way that hasn't been done in a very long time.
But is he hopeful?
Yeah, I mean, if his message resonates, again, maybe not with you, it's sort of like, I hate to say this because they'll cringe when I say this, Donald Trump's message is hopeful for those for whom it's intended. Bernie Sanders' message is hopeful for those for whom it's intended. It's not, you know, if you're a wealthy American, Bernie Sanders' message is horrifying. But if you're not, and you're a struggling, single mom, then his message is very hopeful. You know, if you are somebody who's living in a border community in the United States and you're kind of fed up with the degradation of your community and you're convinced that a porous border and lackluster, you know, resources at the border, then somebody coming along and saying build the wall and we'll make the Mexicans pay for it, as ludicrous as that may seem, that's a hopeful message to you. So Pierre Poilievre comes along and says to people in the energy sector that, you know, we're going to stop beating you up and thinking that your industry is toxic and ugly and evil and awful. And not only do we want to stop you from developing your resource, but we want to punish people in this country from consuming your product that you're out there spending weeks and months away from your family trying to get out of the ground and get out of the sands and get to global markets. Like, we're going to stop punching you in the face. You know, if you're an environmental activist in the Danforth or in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and to you that might be abhorrent, but if you live in Fort Mac or if you live in Leduc, that's a really hopeful message that you haven't heard in a really long time.
So you're adding a bit of nuance to this point you're making about hope. Instead of it really being about the tenor, you're sort of saying in the point that the politician is making, that you can see a hopeful future for yourself in it, maybe more so than.
And not all messages are for all audiences, right? And everybody kind of understands that. You know, Steve Schmidt, a good friend of mine who ran John McCain's campaign in 2008, he puts it very well, where he says that, you know, the history, you know, historically in politics, voters choose their politicians. Well, now we know that politicians can choose their voters because of the way in which we do analysis, the way in which we database, the way in which we focus group test, we fine tune our messaging, we get a sense of who's most fed up with the status quo and who's more open to change and who's more open to leaving their traditional voting patterns of NDP and crossing to the conservatives for the first time. So political parties, sophisticated ones, understand that, you know, you can choose your voting coalition and you can align people along a message of commonality that historically might not have been there. And that's not Machiavellian or creepy or corrupt. That's actually healthy in a democracy, because in a democracy, you know, the elected dynamic should be representative of the people, not, you know, and it shouldn't be forced down, right? So having political systems and our capacity to draw in data and to understand messaging and to reflect people's ambitions, anxieties, fears, and hopes back to them through our political messaging, I think is healthy in a democracy. Otherwise, you just get declining voter participation, people getting more angry, and you know, populism in a way that's really unhealthy, not the kind of political engagement that we hope to see as those of us who have been political actors.
Well, but challenge me on this, but I would say that the tenor does really matter in the hope message, and that the point that you're making about the kind of decline of trust in institutions and belief in politicians and large institutions is precisely because we've leaned too much on that incredibly pessimistic, cruel, tear it down, anti-authoritarian type message. I'm kind of confused by your nuance on hope.
Well, I think it's a fine line, right? I mean, you may not have seen it, but when I was an incumbent member of parliament and a cabinet minister, and people and Justin Trudeau and others were saying that I was a homophobe and anti-women, and I didn't believe in climate science, and I didn't believe in the environment, and I didn't care about Indigenous reconciliation, I thought that was pretty divisive.
Yeah.
And I thought it was pretty untrue. Yeah. And so, you know, you can say that Pierre Poilievre is, you know, he's saying act the tax and build the homes and gatekeepers and all this stuff, and he's being divisive. Well, you know, when liberals run campaigns saying Stephen Harper's going to have soldiers in the streets and James Moore doesn't care about at-risk youth and that I'm, you know, a homophobe and all, like, that's pretty divisive stuff, right? And none of it is true, and it's all nonsense. And it's
the way you're expressing, you know, that right now, is that essentially the defund CBC argument? I mean, in terms of how many of the conservatives feel about how they're portrayed?
No, not necessarily. I wouldn't bridge those two. That'd be a separate conversation. But I'm just, you know, to Kate's point though about, you know, rhetoric and what constitutes hopefulness and it depends on where you are, right? If you're I think a lot of people, for example, with the federal budget, you know, increasing the inclusion rate for capital gains tax over $250,000 a year, for some people that was just an evil, nasty, awful attack. Well, that's less than 1% of Canadians. And some people who are worried about what that means for entrepreneurial inbound investment. For other people who understand it, they might not think that that's particularly cruel and ugly fiscal policy that's divisive, right? So it depends on your perspective of things. And in a democracy, everybody, I think, should have a sense that somebody is talking like they talk and using language that they use and are talking about the issues that they're concerned about. And I think, you know, if we didn't learn anything from some of the social movements that we've seen in the past, I'm thinking about things like Idle No More and like Indigenous voices that have been left out of the conversation for far too long, for them rising up and saying, hey, pay attention to us and have a dialogue with us. That moved the needle dramatically in terms of everybody's obligation to have a reasonable approach to Indigenous reconciliation, as an example, right? So voices should not be left out. And that includes, I think, everybody in a proper liberal democracy.
Well, I will circle back to the CBC thing because I'm interested in that as an example. Because I obviously I've campaigned on the center right here in BC. So I've gone through my own frustrations about how sometimes you're, as you were just expressing a few minutes ago, how your motives are characterized by your political opponents and vice versa, they would complain the same.
Yeah.
So I just wondered whether the vein that Poilievre has been tapping into, when obviously evidenced by, you know, big rallies and thousands of people in various places around Canada, he's tapping into something, and I feel like it's connected to the views of our national institutions, how people may not feel they're represented, that those institutions are representing them, right? with yeah. CPC as a kind of a potential flashpoint there. And I mean, how do you, I mean, you haven't been Heritage Minister. I'm sure you have a very intimate view of the CPC, but
yeah, I mean,
what's behind that?
Sure. I mean, I think a few different things. I mean, the example that I gave to the current president of the CBC, and what I said to her was, you know, if TV Ontario, right, which is a public broadcaster in the province of Ontario, if they were to receive a 25% cut, there would be equal measure of disappointment from the right and the left in Ontario because they do good programming. If the CBC was cut 25% in a federal budget, the NDP and the hard left would go apoplectic, and the hard right would say that's not even nearly deep enough. That's measure enough of sort of the dissociation and how this institution has become a political football. And I think that's really unfortunate for a whole bunch of reasons. You know, their viewership is way, way down for a whole bunch of reasons. It's in their mandate that they're supposed to reflect the, you know, the diversity of Canada back to Canadians. And I don't think that a lot of conservatives for a long time have felt that their views are reflective in the broadcaster. And that's problematic. You know, you have the ad issue panel, which is the marquee panel. You have, you know, three people from the province of Ontario, one person from Montreal, who all agree on almost every single issue, deriving sort of consensus opinion about things. Like, I think there's a frustration there, I think, by a lot of conservatives. There's that. Where I disagree with a lot of my conservative colleagues, though, historically, on their view about the CBC, is that historically, you know, going back to your point about Brian Mulroney, one of the key messages, and I think that should have come through in his passing, was that he had two great legacies. One was free trade, a substantive policy legacy. His second legacy, though, is one that transcends left right, which is the number one obligation for any prime minister going forward at all times in this country is national unity. That's the number one obligation of the Prime Minister of Canada, because we're a country that's been historically defined by our cleavages, East and West, Francophone, Anglophone, Protestant, Catholic in the early days, indigenous, non, North, South, all that. And for this country, 37th largest in population, but second largest in size, for this large, diverse country to stay united, we do need some commonality of interest in institutions. And so, well, the CBC has had its failures for sure. You know, for French-speaking Canadians, 2.5 million French-speaking Canadians outside of the province of Quebec, culture and the arts and language policy is fundamental to their sense of belonging within this country. Mm-hmm. And for French speaking Canadians and Quebecers, many of them feel like they're a postage stamp in the middle of a football field culturally. And the institutions like the CBC at Radio-Canada, they provide the physical infrastructure that allows their language and culture to be shared, sustained, and understood, not just within Quebec, but across this country. And so you can't say we will get rid of CBC or defund the CBC, but only the English part. We'll get rid of the digital. We'll get rid of the TV, but we'll keep the French part and we'll isolate it. But don't worry, we'll come right up to the water's edge and stop right there. And don't worry, you'll be safe and your language and culture will be sustained. For a lot of French Canadians, they kind of go, I don't believe you. And I don't believe that that's good enough. And I don't feel safe that my language and culture will be protected by that. It'll be up to Pierre Poilievre, should become prime minister of the Conservative Party, to backfill that with other commitments in order to keep the French language and culture feeling safe and sound within a united Canada. Because it is the fundamental obligation of the prime minister of the country to keep the country united like that. And by the way, I do think there's also a growing storm in the province of Quebec, right? You see the unpopularity of François Legault. You see the rise of the Parti Québécois. It seems like issues and dynamics in Canada have a way of sort of resurfacing and resurfacing. The Parti Québécois, number one in the polls with an absolute commitment to hold a referendum. And you have possibly Pierre Poilievre becoming prime minister, with promising to get rid of a carbon tax, with an approach to pipelines, with an approach to climate change that is not the same as has been the historic sort of consensus within the province of Quebec. And then on top of that, you have possible culture wars, which I know a lot about having been the Heritage Minister. I think that there's an alchemy there of division that is going to be something to keep an eye on. It's not right there now, but it should be on everybody's radar plot of issues to keep an eye on that. I can imagine in 3-4 years time, I think we could be having a very serious conversation about Quebec again and its relationship with Ottawa and the rest of the country, and CBC and culture is part of that.
Where's BC in that conversation? We always worry that we last to see the outcome of the election. Are we hitting at our weight now in national politics? Is there an understanding there? Do you see problems ahead?
I mean, I think we've gone, frankly, through a period of docility. I think John Horgan's great accomplishment as premier of the province was through a divisive time and through a challenging time of COVID and a time of division within the NDP, is, you know, is, and moving forward in a transition to government through the minority and then the coalition with the Green Party and coming forward. I think, you know, he was a statesman, which is why he's now actually is a statesman, of course, in Germany. And then David Eby, I think, is sort of held over the same kind of temperament. But I think British Columbia has some real issues, and is, I think there's increasingly a dynamic in British Columbia where we're looking for a bit of a fighter. I think that's reflected in some of the polls. I think the BC Conservative Party, their bump in the polls is entirely a borrowed brand of spillover from the federal dynamic. I don't think John Rustad has done anything particularly unique to himself that has caused that number to pop up. But the softness of the NDP numbers, I mean, we can't have had for the past year sort of the top two issues in the country being the cost of living crisis, where Vancouver and area is kind of the tip of the spear of the crisis of the cost of living and the cost of housing, number one. And then number two, the issue that's been forced onto the national spotlight because of Pierre Poilievre's persistence is the carbon tax, and British Columbians paying the highest cost for fuel on the continent. And we were the vanguard of it. And there's sort of political consensus on the issue of carbon price, or has been for the past decade, where you have more than a third or 40% of British Columbians saying that they don't like the carbon tax. And then you've got the cost of living crisis and there's no political voice for it. Well, the conservative brand is going to get a pop and it's going to be a disruption. And so I think federally for British Columbia, I think British Columbians are looking for some voices and for some fighters. And historically we have found them in the personalities like Chuck Cadman or Sven Robinson or Randy White or others who have been sort of, you know, boisterous voices from the outside. I think people are now looking for more sustained, substantive voices for a British Columbia interest in the federal dynamic.
Both Mike DeYoung and Ian Black and Ellis Ross and Dan Ashton running federally, should the Conservatives rebrand as the BC Liberals?
Exactly. Well, that's certainly not BC right. United. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I mean, I think all that stuff is a good thing, right? We can pivot to BC politics a bit if you like, but I think all that stuff is genuinely good, right? And, you know, and by the way, on the carbon tax in British Columbia, like I sort of explained to a friend of mine the other day from Toronto, I was like, they said, what's going on in BC? I said, well, so the incumbent NDP government is supporting the current price on carbon, but they were against it when it came in. But the official opposition, Kevin Falcon, he's really against the carbon tax, although he was in cabinet when the BC Liberals brought it in, but now he's against it. But he's being called out for not really being against it because he was for it when it was brought in by John Rustad and the Conservatives, who are really against it. But he was also in the cabinet of the government that brought it in, but the incumbent government was against it. But so, you know, I guess the point is, you hang around politics long enough, everybody disappoints you.
Or one big circle.
Yeah, picking that up then, I think James, because I do want to just like drive into this dynamic that we have, that Premier Eby's approval ratings and the approval of him remains somewhat robust, seemingly robust, but then the sort of wrong track for the government, it does seem more and more people seem to feel that the government is on the wrong track. And we are now, you know, a couple months out anyway, it would seem, from an election at the most. So does it feel to you like David Eby is vulnerable?
He is vulnerable. You know, you can't have right track, wrong track numbers trending in the directions that they are right now and have that be sustainable. What's missing, or there are a couple of ingredients that are missing from this being I think informed opinion that I've read, that the NDP should be reelected. I mean, looks like they're on track to be reelected, but they are vulnerable. The gap is narrowing. He is down from the John Horgan highs. But what's missing for that to be a real threat to them at this point, number one, is a credible alternative that is united, like actually united, number one. But two, where they really would get into a danger zone if there was some kind of a scandal or a crisis at the core of the government that would challenge their competency. The NDP is, I think, seen by a lot of British Columbians as at core a competent, seasoned government, because they are a seasoned government with competent and thoughtful people at the cabinet table, people like Mike Farnworth and others who are judicious, thoughtful, temperamentally humble, present well, carry themselves well, don't overpromise. And I think British Columbians kind of generally like that tone. I think that's part of that style, is kind of those were the best parts of John Horgan, the best parts of Gordon, of Glenn Clark, rather, when he was in government, is that when he sort of had that sort of more judicious approach to governing responsibly. Now they're sort of seen as the reasonable governors. But I think when you have the cost of living issues, carbon tax issues, which are only going to increase in their velocity and intensity between now and next year with a federal election campaign, and certainly through the summer barbecue circuit with federal politics, you know, the NDP are vulnerable, but it requires an opposition party that's going to galvanize it with a credible leader that is united. But I think a serious scandal or a serious misstep by the provincial government on the competency side could really cause a downward slide that you can't really escape yourself from.
Yes. So one of my co-hosts, I think it was Jeff, likes to make the reference to events, dear boy, events.
Yeah.
Who's the quote from, Jeff?
So that's probably me.
Harold Macmillan. So I'm
pretty sure. I can't miss
you. Both did.
Okay, you both did.
We were both there with Harold Macmillan.
Long time ago.
Long time ago.
Well, James, yeah, like, it just in terms of picking up on, you know, time for a change or any angst that's there or not there out in the Tri-Cities area, your stomping grounds. I mean, what does your tummy tell you? Like, is there a chance out there that there could be a serious contest if there's a clear not NDP alternative? Would it be a horse race out there?
That's actually really hard to say, because in the Tri-Cities, you have, on the provincial side, there's four ridings.
Yeah.
Nobody's really running that I noticed. I mean, there's some people who are running. BC Conservatives seem to be the only people who are actually campaigning. In my riding, I've received two direct mailouts from, like, and again, not dropped in the doorstep, but they actually had some money to put it in the paid mail.
The BC Conservatives.
From the provincial Conservatives. BC Liberals or BC United are nowhere. They don't have, as far as I can tell, a riding association or people who are running or wanting to run. You know, I talk to people all the time who think about running for office out here, and there's nobody that I know who's running. No, like, it's, you know, city councils are often places where people, you know, think about running for higher office. There's just no interest. You know, the BC United experiment has not, I think, so far gone well. I like Kevin Falcon a lot. He's a friend of mine. I wish him well. I think he would be a fantastic premier. I really believe that. But, you know, the rebranding and the redirection has not gone well. It's and the thing is, if you say to an average anybody, and you say, I'm the leader of a Green Party, or I'm the leader of a Labour Party, or I'm the leader of a Conservative Party, nominally, like, in the back of my brain, I immediately know about 2/3 about what you're about. You know, whatever the contemporary expression of that is in terms of policy, ideologically, in terms of values, I know where you are. But when you're in your BC United, it's a call to action, and that's fine. You can have parties that are a call to action. When I was first elected, it was the Canadian Reform Conservative Alliance, because of the call to action to unite as progressive conservatives and reformers to defeat the Liberals. And it's fine to have a call to action as your title of your party. However, unite for what? Unite for whom? Unite against what? Unite against whom? And none of those four things have been defined. And so it's one thing to say BC United, we're pushing away from the Liberal brand, as all parties in Western Canada seem to be. That's fine. But if you're going to be a BC United party, then you'd got to be really clear about what you're uniting for or against in terms of personality or policy. And I think that's now been missing. And also, like, and it's not uncommon for an opposition party to not necessarily be united and have clarity about what you're for. It's really rare for an opposition party to not be united and clear about what they're against. Are you against safe supply? Are you against the carbon tax? Or are you against Justin Trudeau's approach to fiscal policy? Are you, like, so there's this vacuum of credibility and consistency in terms of values by a party that is a call to action, I think is why the party is struggling so badly.
Well, James, Mike has a political Big Bang theory you may be familiar with, and continues to hold hope that there will be a unification between the Conservatives and BC United before the election. I think he's turned me and Jeff into political creationists, if that's the counterpoint to that.
Yeah.
Well, do you see any hope? Do you see any hope for that?
I mean, never say never, I suppose, but it's all fratricide at this point, like political fratricide, because it's all. Like, and until all the personalities and MLAs and people are all on the same team, united and pointing to one leader and saying that she or he must be the premier of this province, we're all bought in and we're all united around this platform and this approach and this brand, until all that happens and everybody else tools down, you can't win. you just can't win. And we saw that federally, even with a marginal split of the People's Party in 2021 and 2019 with Maxime Bernier not being fully engaged. Like, even that minor split is just not good enough. But again, the NDP are vulnerable. And I think whether they're vulnerable this fall, they're vulnerable in time, because they're hitting the same clock that Justin Trudeau is hitting in terms of the time scale, right? Of the 8 to 10 year time window. They're going to be hitting that very soon. A lot of cabinet ministers are either not going to offer again this fall, or this is their last go. And you know, the time for change pendulum is going to start swinging, but it won't be captured by the other side until they tools down, come together, and put the province first with a coherent plan and a credible leader who is thoughtful, cultured, and understands the province well.
So I would contend yeah. that what you've just expressed there is obvious. It's there for everyone to see of what's going to happen with votes. And so my point is that 5 months out, everyone knows that this is the problem. Like, everyone knows this is where it's heading. So why have the car crash? Why not just steer the car away from the accident scene? So that's why I still think there's time. And because I think the support base of both parties want it at the end of the day. So anyway,
well, I mean, what could, again,
I may be wrong, but
yeah, I mean, what could be a catalyst would be a catastrophic to the incumbent government, an auditor general's report or a scandal or a policy that comes down, or an alignment with Justin Trudeau that's so appalling to the British Columbia interest, or some kind of a regional issue that emerges where David Eby is just tone deaf to the public, or any, like, these things can happen. But I think David Eby has so far shown himself as, in terms of his public presentation, his demeanor, his temperament, the way in which he talks and presents about issues, that he's a very cool, thoughtful person who doesn't take risks. And you know, against the image of David Eby that was presented of this sort of, you know, ideological far left guy who's an academic who's kind of rigid about things, he's actually shown himself to be very pragmatic and very thoughtful and very measured about his approach to things, which is why, you know, they're sitting at over 40% support, double the support that Jagmeet Singh has. There's a reason for that, right? Because I think he understands British Columbia temperament better than people have been in British Columbia for twice as long as he's been.
Well, should that occasion arise, should there be political blood in the water in the next few months, we will remind our listeners, James, that the advice to the right and the center right is United works more as an action item than as a brand or a name for a political party.
And, yes.
And, okay.
And I would say as well that very often in politics, politicians think that elections are about them, their leadership, their background, their biography, their great idea for fixing everything. And voters tend to think that elections are about them, their concerns, and their priorities. And the voters are right. It's about them. So if you're talking about stuff that isn't on the public's menu and their appetite list, you are completely missing the moment. The politicians have to reflect the public back to them in terms of the substance of the issues they care about, the tone and the language, and the correct amount of heat and the proper remedies. Like, you genuinely have to listen to things. In British Columbia, our most successful premiers in BC have always been people who have had a proper, genuine populist instinct about things. And Christy Clark had that. W.A.C. Bennett had that. Bill Bennett in his peak moments had that. Gordon Campbell, you know, had that as well at the peak of his powers. Like, just that genuine understanding of kind of, you know, just a feel for the province, a true populist instinct. And it's not a right wing or left wing thing, but, you know, knowing where the pressure points are in the province and knowing how to listen. And when you lose that, and it's over.
Is there any chance you can fire up your old website, NDP?
NDP, my student project from 25 yes, years ago or whatever. Yes.
Do you still have the domain name?
Yeah.
Somebody
yeah,
might
you
want
remember
it.
That. Yeah, no.
Exactly. Oh, I remember. I remember everything.
The peak of my youthful self-righteousness about the horrors of radical socialism, as I saw it.
The Jeff Meigs government.
Well, I've often met those reform NDP crossovers that you talk about.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you earlier, it's maybe too late, but it's sort of a class dimension to the Pierre Poilievre approach that we haven't seen before from the conservatives. So there was a refusal to agree that we're just the upper crusty class, we're the elite class. And reaching overtly to, as you say, blue-collar people is a new dynamic that I think is really changing how politics is playing out here.
Yeah, and it's, a window of opportunity was created. You know, Jack Layton was a populist, but in a different way. And frankly, since his passing, I think the NDP, like there's the, Jack Layton had the big pop in the province of Quebec, of course, in 2011. They won all those seats in Quebec. And then they pivoted to Thomas Mulcair as leader, where there was a real emphasis on holding the seats in Quebec and trying to replace the Liberals as fiscally responsible or credible political party, which then, you know, fell against the Trudeau message of 2015, as we talked about. And so then there was a void created about what is the NDP and where do we go? And then in comes Jagmeet Singh and the issues that the NDP talk about now. And I think for 5 to 8 years now, the NDP, if you look at, like, I don't watch Question Period that often federally, but every now and then I'll flip it on. And if you look at the issues that are sort of dominating the dialogue of New Democrats, it's not the issue of, you know, a frustrated out of work private sector union logger from Mid Island is worried about, like, you know, issues like, you know, will the government meet its climate change targets for 2030 and condemning conservatives for being insufficiently outraged at somebody who doesn't express the right solidarity with the transgender movement, or like, or what you get my point is that it's the NDP is focused more on ideological and identity issues rather than on economic and class issues, as has historically been the case. And I just think there's a gulf that's been opened up by the weakness of Jagmeet Singh's leadership that is pretty dramatic. And I think a lot of people who are, you know, who believe in bargaining collectively, who believe that they should have a right to a good wage, and they want their employer to recognize their contract and bargain fairly and give them a fair share. But they also want their kids to go to a school that's clean and sturdy and is sending them out into the world properly, ready for the world that's around them. And they also want to make sure that criminals aren't victims. I'm the victim of criminals, and that police are there to, like, there's a balanced sort of common sense voter value representation that historically has voted NDP, that's probably still there with a lot of provincial New Democrats, that has drifted away from the federal NDP for a long time. And it's interesting, Pierre Poilievre, unlike any leader in my 24, 25 years in politics, or more than that now, but Pierre Poilievre comes to British Columbia once a month, every month. That's more than Stephen Harper did when he was prime minister. That's more than Stockwell Day did. That's more than Preston Manning did, even though he was rooted in Calgary. Pierre is here every month, at least, you know, for a few days every single month in British Columbia, because it matters to him. The swing seats are here. And when he comes to British Columbia, he's going to Campbell River, right? He's going to Midway, British Columbia. He's
at Vancouver Community College in front of all the apprentices.
Yeah, and he's going to Sparwood, right? And he's going to places like that, where, you know, he's going to Rosslyn and Trail and you know, and other places. He's going to, of course, you know, Kitimat and elsewhere. And so he's spending a lot of time in places in Port Hardy, like, that was they're a hassle to get to when you're coming from Ottawa. And he's got a young family in the Ottawa Valley and all that. But it's those are the sort of the forgotten voices and the next 5-10 seats from British Columbia that'll make a real difference for him as he pursues a majority.
Well, Honorable James Moore, it's a pleasure to have you on Hotel Pacifico. Thanks for checking in with us. And we enjoyed the discussion, both federal and provincial topics. And we won't defund you anytime soon. And I hope you don't defund the Hotel Pacifico. But we look forward to having you on the show some other time as well. Thanks for coming in.
Guess we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. Nearly half of all women in Canada will experience an incident of gender-based violence, which means if you think you don't know anyone who's been impacted, you're wrong. Because gender-based violence takes place in Canada every day. In BC, according to the Moosehide Campaign, there are over 60,000 physical or sexual assaults against women every year. That's more than 1,000 per week. A cornerstone of the Moosehide Campaign is the Moosehide Pin, a symbol of medicine which can be worn as a commitment to honor, respect, and protect the women and children in your life. To date, the organization has gifted over 5 million moosehide pins to Canadians. The moosehide pins are considered as small pieces of land medicine and a gift to any and all Canadians who are called to help create a country safe for all women and children and those along the gender continuum. Moose nourish their bodies by eating leaves, bark, and twigs from trees and shrubs on the land. They breathe fresh air and drink from clear streams. Each May, the Moosehide Campaign team hosts the annual Walk to End Violence in Victoria, BC, which includes the opportunity to fast, learn, and support the campaign both in person and virtually. This year's campaign day is just weeks away, May 16th, and there will be events across the province. TELUS team members will be taking part in Walks to End Violence in Victoria, Burnaby, Prince George, and Nelson. The Moosehide campaign team is looking for volunteers to help make this important walk and to end violence happen. If you're in the Victoria area and would like to give some of your time to this important movement, visit moosehidecampaign.ca to learn more. And wherever you live or work, don't forget to wear your Moosehide pin on May 16th.
Hello. You've reached the Hotel Pacifico Strategy Suite.
Mike, I was actually following in your footsteps this weekend. Well, to Las Vegas and to the Sphere. Right. I saw a very different act.
Yes.
Yeah, a higher quotient of Birkenstocks, I'm thinking, at the version I saw compared to the U2 performance you saw.
Sounds about right in your crowd. Yeah.
It was like me and like every Gen Xer in Vermont, from Vermont was there. But I went to see Phish on the weekend in the Sphere, and I have to say it was astounding. I had my doubts. Yeah.
Farmed or wild?
No, the PH Phish.
Oh,
you're big in the 90s. They were big in the 90s, Mike, which I know
you were not familiar with them. But, yeah. Sorry.
Sustainably raised.
I thought this was a CC Politics show.
Jeff, you don't know Phish either, do you?
No.
No.
He's Woody Guthrie.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But we probably have like two listeners who get the reference anyway.
It's a pretty amazing facility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need a Sphere up here.
We need a Sphere. That is the conclusion.
That'd be a great election promise by someone, because I don't think Science World's going to cut it as a Sphere.
No.
Well, they only need about $20 million to continue operating as they are. So, large sum.
And the Royal Museum can hold on a bit longer. Let's build a Sphere. Or let's build a Sphere next to it.
Jeff, maybe that's where you guys went wrong on the museum. You should have been the Royal BC Sphere.
I think spheres are strictly private sector.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Fair enough. Yeah. A few cool billion there. Yeah. Well, yeah. So,
I've got some news.
News.
Listener news.
Okay.
I had one of our first gifts for our YouTube viewers. Let's call this person Five Star Red. Five Star Red went out and got shots for us. Called Island Thunder. They're teal blue shots. I don't believe it's an endorsement of BC United's new color scheme, but you never know. So we've got four vodka shots that at some future date in a live, when we're all together live, we can have some Island Thunder. And Vancouver Island maybe? I don't know. I think they're actually from New Zealand. But anyways, thank you, Five Star Red, for thinking of us and providing actual review in the form of alcohol, as opposed to the virtual ones, which are also good. And we appreciate that. And we also had a great review the other day from someone by the name of Vidovin. I can't pronounce his last name, but thank you, Vidovin, for your review as well.
That was well, let's get into review. It. Let's get into one. It. Let's Ready. Get into it. All right. Ready, Jeff?
Ready.
Ready. All right. Because we're in the denouement of the session. And I think the government has a pretty packed agenda. I was looking at it this morning. I mean, it was sort of five bills at committee, five at second reading, although that number, breaking news as of just a few hours ago, went down to four. With the government backing off on Bill 12, which was the Public Health Accountability and Cost Recovery Act. I want to back up on this one because I feel like I know this one was less on my radar compared to other ones. And Jeff, can you set us up a bit? Like, what was the purpose of this act?
Well, I think what the government had in mind and what people perceived or feared were two very different things. Because if you trace the genesis of this bill back to the early weeks of the session, and I've been saying there's 3 weeks left, which is wrong. There's 4 weeks left. And in the last stretch of a session, a week is like a generation practically. So there was a fair amount of time left, but this was going to be a very contentious bill because it was described as giving the government the power to deal with faceless corporations that were causing harm. And it took a bit of work to decode the fact that this harm was really the harm caused by social media and abuse of social media that may lead children to commit suicide because they're being extorted by sexting or other horrible things that are starting to happen more systematically on social media. So I think the premier had an early announcement with the family who had lost a child to suicide as a result of that. But there wasn't a really strong line drawn to that. And the bill itself was structured to provide a general power for the government to try to rectify harm and recover healthcare costs that were caused by that. So if you think back to the overprescribing of opioids, you know, the big pharma should not have done what they did, and there's costs associated with it, so they should pay compensation. Tobacco companies, same thing. But for a whole lot of companies out there in BC business world who had lawyers who were reading this legislation, it seemed like a complete assault on anybody who might raise their head above ground. And the government has spent quite a bit of time trying to play defense on this, while a huge coalition of just about every business organization in the province has written anxious letters saying you should not do this. So today, this morning, just before we came down to a tape, we see that the bill has been hoisted or put aside. So and because they've now got a table to discuss some of these issues with Meta and X and TikTok and a couple I didn't even know existed, but they're there potentially doing harm and trying to avoid getting charged for it. So we'll see how this plays out. But I think this bill is over for now.
Yeah. Can you walk us through, Mike, a bit more of the pushback that came from small business and why they became concerned?
Well, I think by my reading of it was that the potential impacts were potentially undefined and potentially large. And given the uncertainty over the way the legislation was written, you know, I think there was, you know, a lot of dire warnings and business acted accordingly. And also like our previous guest on Hotel Pacifico, Rachel Curran, would have been one of those involved in having dialogue with the government to point out what the, you know, the negative impacts are that they may not have anticipated. Now, so on the one hand, it's, you know, another example of sober second thought, and or W.A.C. Bennett, the famous second look, or whatever they used to call that, which, you know, is a good thing when governments, they don't feel they got it right, they climb down. You know, that's better than
there's a second subplot here, Mike, which was that the premier was notably furious last year when the wildfires were complicated by the fact that the big platforms, especially Facebook, were not allowing media stories to be reposted. And it was clear he was trying to sort that out as well.
Yeah, and that's one thing he can say he got out of the process here. But Kevin Falcon's point that in his statement this afternoon is valid as well, which is like, here's another example of the government climbing down on an issue that's gone out. And then in the face of opposition, which obviously the opposition can take credit for harnessing that, both in the legislature, but business groups and others around the province, here's yet another example of the NDP after rolling something out or rolling it right back, like Land Act, and several other examples that I'm sure we can remind ourselves of. So, you know, there have been a lot of these, you know, comparatively speaking to, let's say, the Horgan government. The EB government seems to be kind of, you know, climbing down, you know, more often than you would expect. So here's another example. Now, will the public even take notice of this? I'm not sure it was a huge public issue. I think it was a stakeholder issue at this point. So I'm not sure there's huge public consequences, but I think within the government, you know, I think the way the government operates and the fact that, you know, the premier's made it clear he will, you know, if the minister hasn't locked it down, the premier may, you know, say time out and go fix it. So.
Well, this is, and you're referring to the fact that he was talking, the premier was talking about how they're going to form this, what are they calling it? The committee, and they're calling everyone to the table, right? And they're kind of kicking it out. And he's saying, if it doesn't get where we want to get, we're going to bring back the legislation. Like, they're going to hold this legislation over their heads as though the jurisdiction of BC and some legislation in our part of our population of 5 million is going to change the way, change Meta's algorithm? Feels a bit like a stretch, I think, is what I'm saying.
Well, the legislation was drafted by the Attorney General's Ministry, I believe, right? And right. So as of like within the last day or two, you know, the Attorney General did not indicate that she was backing down on it. And then they did. So it's another example where the Premier's office has to get involved and they have to expend time and focus to fix a problem where, you know, probably would rather be playing offense and talking about the good things.
I see it a bit differently, Mike. I think they were involved from the get-go. You know, the Premier was at this announcement, and I know he's at most announcements, but this was something he was very, you know, personally identified with. And that's even in highlighted in the in the message this morning from the Premier's office about withdrawing the bill. But I think there's a practical question that Kate points to with these comments, which is it possible to bring the bill back? You're going to bring it back in a week or 2 weeks, or do you think you're going to bring it back right before the election? You know, realistically, it's a pretty tough thing, as you say, when the public's not really clear there's a problem and probably are missing the solution as well, to then, you know, fire up the House again for something that's actually quite complicated. Not a simple matter, probably.
This is probably a post-election.
Yeah.
Bring back at this point, right?
But I want to relate this to a conversation I think we had when all the kind of housing and density related legislation came out in quick succession. And I think both of you were sort of pointing to a risk that will emerge for this government and sort of their actors and their movers. And what happens when you're actors and movers is at some point you start moving too quickly. And particularly, I'd say, without your stakeholders. And does that feel like that's what we're seeing more broadly with this?
I think that the view in Victoria in the government side is that this has produced the outcome they were hoping for, which was to create a place where they could discuss these social media harms. And they're trying to create a dynamic of negotiation that will continue and, you know, with some urgency. But I think, as Mike says, a lot of other people who probably had no reason to be riled up are riled up, and it's not exactly clear what the remedy will look like. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky road for the government to walk. And it was a day when I thought there was actually some other pretty good news. Like yesterday, the HIDA legislation came in, and it was well received. Although Michael Lee obviously signaled that he was prepared to be critical in debate. He was careful not to say anything that would offend the HIDA, who he expressed a lot of regard for. John Rustad made it all. It'd be very difficult for John Rustad, conservative leader, having said what he said in debate, to now vote against the bill, which is where you might expect most of the opposition to come from on a bill that's you know, an important change in terms of recognizing title in Haida Gwaii. The Green Party, of course, liked it too. So that was good. And then a date for the transition to Surrey Police, which is a battle that those of us who follow will be glad to see end. It sounds like Minister Farnworth is pretty clear on what he has to do here and what has to be done, and that'll be it right after the election. But still, putting a pin in that, everybody hopes, I think, except maybe the RCMP and Murlock.
Last night, I attended the Greater Vancouver Board of Trade Awards gala. I was not wearing a tuxedo, just so you're clear on that, Kate. But the Premier was there, and he showed up, and he made his remarks and paid tribute to one of the award winners, Nature Path founders. And what struck me about that, well, you did mention the HIDA thing, Jeff, as you just highlighted. But it's like, okay, here's a busy guy who's the House is sitting. You know, he's got a young family. Here he is at a Vancouver Board of Trade gala on a Monday night. And so credit to him for showing up and keeping that relationship with business in check, or trying to anyways, right? Even though, like, this Bill 12 thing was burbling along and it got fixed that day. But obviously it's not a hostile audience for the Premier if he's deciding to show up. And that's different than some of the situations we've had in the past. So no Falcon, no Rustad. You know, mm-hmm. they can't be everywhere, but they weren't there, and EB was. And it was a business crowd. So I thought that was interesting that he is doing his bit to, you know, neutralize any potential opposition there. So I thought that was, you know, from here we are 5 months from election, and that's they're covering that base.
It's actually a great place to move to. We have a clipping this week. So the clipping I'm talking about, I think Jeff, did you share it first? Share it around with the group, but it's an editorial in the Times columnist.
I think it was me.
It was you. Sorry, giving credit to Jeff over you. It's okay, Mike. Thanks for the lovely clipping you shared around.
You're welcome.
I will try and summarize this editorial, which basically says, you know, in BC, the EB government's not being held to account, that, you know, generally that's the role of the opposition, and we haven't seen them doing that effectively. And that, you know, voters need to do that in this upcoming election. Do you agree with that assessment? Is the opposition not holding up that end of the bargain for the voters, Mike?
What's interesting about the editorial is, I guess, what they're getting at the end of the day, and I'm not sure who writes the Times columnist editorials, but is this tapping into this frustration in the not NDP party, as Jess Ketchum likes to say.
I like it.
Where's the clear alternative? And, you know, the NDP have got policies. They need to be tested. There needs to be a clear alternative to test them. Can't these guys get organized and do that, right? And, you know, I definitely, there were criticisms mounted towards government and then editorial. I obviously have a point of view on it. So I think that's interesting clipping just to highlight. We've talked about week after week here is just this ongoing kind of primary on the right as to how that's going to get sorted out. And I think the Times columnist is just a proof point of the rising chatter level about the angst that's there on the right side of the spectrum. In part because I think there's a feeling that the government support is a little soft and certainly not at a crisis point or anything like that, but it's just, they're in that, in the recent polls are in the kind of lowish 40s, and that's a competitive place if there's another party in the high 30s. But that's not the case right now, unless you choose to believe one of the polls that's out there. So anyways, that's my take on it.
I really enjoyed the editorial because it's so quaint that, you know, no one ever reads editorials anyway, even when newspapers were a big deal. And so we have this little, newspapers are no longer a big deal.
I won't argue that part.
Sacrilege.
Editorials were only read by a tiny part of newspaper readership.
I mean, there was a time, and I'm young enough, or I'm old enough to, I don't know how to frame that, but there was a time in my time in journalism when the editorials really mattered, in particular the endorsements, we'll say. So
yeah, but this one, the Times columnist one, the only thing they didn't blame the government for was proliferation of bike lanes and you know, the absence of dog parks, you know, the maintenance on the lawn bowling courts is tumbling. And that's because Rustad and Falcon are playing stupid ego games. And as Mike says, they should understand there's a bigger principle here, which is to kick out the NDP. And that's what it came down to at the very end. There wasn't a single issue. There were just scores of issues that were irritating them. And I won't go through all of them. And I was joking about some of them. But, you know, Mike has been teasing me about saying, I don't think they're going to get it together. It's still my view, Mike, that they're not going to get it together.
I'll bet you four shots of Island Thunder on that. So.
Well, I don't know. I think that it's very interesting because there was a second clipping, which our readers may have seen. And again, a venerable observer of BC politics and a guest on Hotel Pacifico, Vaughn Palmer, went through a whole bunch of things that are going on out there. Yeah. And expressed the view as well that there was, you know, some hay to be made here by someone who would finally tee off on the NDP. But it's not happening. And was reporting some rumors that Brad West, another Hotel Pacifico graduate, was going to be somehow maneuvered into Kevin Falcon's shoes. I don't know where Kevin Falcon was going to go in time for a huge unity move before the election, which, as he said, are the kinds of fanciful thoughts that often happen when the right is divided. So we're certainly seeing some fanciful ones right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I read the Von Palmer column too, and I'm just a little sorry that he didn't quote Hotel Pacifico and the interview we had with Brad West, where he discussed where his lack of political home was, or was not where it wasn't, where it wasn't. But
very clear.
So Von, please listen carefully to our podcast.
Yeah, just for our listeners, Mike, some of whom may have doubts because they're hearing it secondhand, I went back and checked the tape, and Brad West said he's not a member of any political party. So
yes,
that's right. He's a member of the Brad West Party, the Brad West Suburban Populist Party.
Yeah.
BWSP.
Yeah. I'm going to go out on a limb too, Mike. And I don't think Von Palmer is a big podcast listener. I think he reads a lot of editorials.
When he's on our podcast, he listens.
When he's on our podcast, he listens. Well, yeah.
But we all listen to Von. We have to. It's our job.
I love reading Von.
Jeff, I can't remember what point you were making that I was disagreeing with, actually, but I'm sure it was quite disagreeable. shall we move on?
Yeah, let's do that. Well, I can pick up on this and just say, on the kind of like, where is the pushback? Where's the strength of the opposition in BC? I think Jess Ketchum was doing some of the work of the opposition this week, in talking about a hidden crime tax. And I'm wondering if you saw this, but he claims the hidden crime tax is up to $824, I think it's a year per household. And it's like hidden costs in retail for, the costs retail locations are accruing to deal with crime that's being passed on to consumers. I think there's two things to pull apart here. I think one is, are the numbers credible? And the other is the point credible? Because I think to start with the numbers, Jeff, 824 is a pretty big number.
Well, apparently it was calculated by taking the shrinkage number for the shrinkage being what you think you're going to be able to sit in the store and sell, and what actually goes out the door. And the difference is put down to all kinds of things, but usually to shoplifting. And what Jess and his group are saying is that there's a huge amount of shoplifting going on, and they had a lot of backup for that. Whether it's that big that you could take the total volume of sales, subtract 1.6%, divide it by the number of households and get $847 is an issue I'll leave to economists. But it's not a tax. It's a problem in the retail sector for sure, and it can't all be handed on to consumers. So I think the point's fair that there's a cost associated with shoplifting. But I think we recall after Jess was on, we talked about that a bit, the police went out here in BC and got hundreds of shoplifters in a matter of a couple of days. And that's happened in some other jurisdictions too. So it's a very interesting question. And whether or not it's part of affordability, I don't know. I hate to quarrel with a veteran like Jess.
Well, I mean, regardless of what the dollar amount is, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to change their mind on the issue based on a study, although it was a good tactic to get some coverage, I assume. I see we have another visitor to Hotel Pacifico today.
I was just, yeah. I
work
was just...
from home day. do what you have to do, Mom. But, to me, the issue is, the people that are watching on Instagram or TikTok videos of something happening on the street. Like I saw one came across my sight line this week of a clerk in a altercation on the sidewalk with someone carrying a bag of stuff they'd stolen out the store. And the clerk was trying to yank it back. And, youngish woman. And I thought, geez, that's dangerous. But she wasn't giving up and she wasn't letting go. And the other guy wasn't letting go and people were recording this. And I thought, and I'm sure that video has been seen tens of thousands of times. And that's the kind of just stuff that gets baked into just people's sensibility on where the crime thing's at right now. And, so it's part of the conversation. And when you see real life kind of, examples of it, that's the most powerful thing, in my opinion, than what the number, the economists think.
Yeah. No, there's no doubt crime is going to be a big issue in this election, one way or the other. And, once again this week, Eleanor Sturco was up in the House seeking to hold the premier's feet to the fire over the decriminalization issue. And we heard a lot on that from Brad West as well. It's not clear to me if you go back to the old system that you're going to see a big difference. When decriminalization occurred, the amount that was agreed would be a threshold for a seizure was the amount agreed to by the police chiefs. That was much less than advocates at the time were interested in. And the government of the day was, the Horgan administration was criticized sharply by advocates for that. The police are saying something different now than they said then. I think that's fair to say. I was very close to that. And they are now saying they warned that there'd be a big problem. The reality is that the policy of police, going back to the days of marijuana, was not to seize people's drugs for personal use. It was a colossal waste of time and money. And I've talked to police officers who said, had they done so and brought in all of the people holding marijuana in the 90s that they could have busted, they would have been chastised by their supervisors for wasting time and money. Mm-hmm. So the number of people actually having drugs seized before decriminalization was very low. And when if and when there's a change here and Oregon has gone back, it'll be very interesting to see whether it has the impact that some people are hoping. You know, the statements made by Kevin Falcon, for example, he'll just say, you know, it can't happen. And that'll be that. It's an indication of how frustrated people are with what's a very complex problem. Mm-hmm. I don't say complex to shrug it off or deflect. I just think mm-hmm. that it's going to be tougher than people think.
Well, there was another memo, I think it was today, leaked out of the health authority, just about how nurses operating in hospitals are supposed to manage patients internally who are using. And it's interesting because, you know, to my understanding, there was always some kind of need to mitigate withdrawal for folks who come in, you know, with addicted to illegal substances. You know, and it's interesting, the last memo got really spun up into, you know, sort of like people using drugs next to babies and throwing knives around. Like, it's tough because I think the politics of this it's on a lot of people's minds. A lot of people are noticing their downtowns or their neighborhoods, and they're seeing more street crime and they're seeing more drug use. But to draw lines between the safe supply policy and what you're seeing might be overly simplistic.
Well, I think, Mike, to your tally, there's two huge issues politically that the government has been very forceful on, which are going to have to go forward into the election unless they change their mind. One is the carbon tax, and the other is this decriminalization issue. And, you know, you can talk about Bill 12 and people will just look blankly at you. They have no idea what it is. They don't understand it if you explain it to them. The government seems to be concerned about algorithms or Facebook's up to no good or whatever. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. The carbon tax and decriminalization are daily matters for people. Mm-hmm. And I think those are going to be very interesting to see play out in the weeks and months ahead, because you know, they're not an easy role for the government by any means.
Yeah.
So really quickly, I just want to touch on the fact that you know, speaking of healthcare, John Rustad was again quoted this week on the vaccine issue, this time talking about compensating nurses who lost their jobs because they refused to get vaccinated. Wanted to ask you, Mike, like, is there a strategy here, or is it just that he can't help himself? Because I feel like John Russ is spending a lot of time talking about vaccines when I think the rest of the world is moved on.
Yeah, I don't really have a handle on that. Like, obviously, the knee-jerk reaction here is that what's he doing messing around this vaccine issue, which seems to create big divisions, you know, in the population. And is there enough votes on his position that help him get elected premier of the province of BC? Certainly there's lots of skepticism on that. However, I mean, I do find it kind of interesting, the attack that is taken with these nurses who choose not to be vaccinated, because there's a lot of unions who go very hard to defend their members from all sorts of infractions, or, you know, whether it's the BCTF or you name longshoremen or whatever, who really defend their members from a lot of stuff, you know. And the government seems to be taking a very hard line with these nurses, And I understand why. It's public health care and protection of and all that. But I just, I find it, I don't understand the, you know, the union side of it, you know, and how unions behave or what they expect from government in these situations. So it's definitely an issue I need to do a little homework.
Well, it's been burbling for a while, Mike, because nurses had a view for a long time they shouldn't have to take the flu shot. And there was always a subset of nurses in the union who were very vocal about that. There was an arbitration which left the issue a bit up in the air, but Bonnie Henry and the public health people were absolutely scandalized that people working in healthcare would refuse to follow science and get vaccinated. So during the pandemic, that got solved on the side of Bonnie Henry. What I think is interesting about what Rustad said is he's prepared to look at compensation for them. So what I took it to be is him giving a signal and a wave. He's virtue signaling to his own crowd, if I can use that term around a conservative. And the rest of us are kind of going, if they're nurses and if COVID's over, why not? But there's a group of people there who, you know, allegedly would solve our healthcare crisis if we could just get them back in and then even compensate them. So it's really kind of a Danielle Smith approach. I think she said much the same.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, an issue to watch.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the virtue signaling thing is bang on, Jeff. So we'll come back to this one. And I'm sure John Russ said will give us occasion too. All right, let's grab a drink.
Have you ever noticed I can go on and on, weeks on end, in fact, about energy efficiency? Well, let's talk now about what that looks like in practice. FortisBC has embarked on a $50 million project aimed at uncovering the best pathway to reduce energy use in older homes and multifamily housing units, an essential step in meeting BC's climate action targets. This is important because older homes and apartment buildings pose a complex challenge, as a significant number were built before energy efficiency was incorporated into the National Energy Code for Buildings over 25 years ago. FortisBC is working to improve the building envelopes and mechanical systems of 20 homes and 4 multi-unit residential buildings across the province. The goal of this pilot is to reduce their energy use and associated GHG emissions by at least 50%. As far as I know, this is actually the largest targeted real-world study of deep energy efficiency upgrades that has taken place in BC homes. And let's not forget that buildings account for over 10% of BC's greenhouse gas emissions. FortisBC will analyze the energy reductions, customer experience, and overall costs, helping realize energy efficiencies with home and building owners in ways that might have been out of reach before. Hey, FortisBC, maybe you should analyze energy efficiency at Hotel Pacifico. Some of the opinions here can sometimes be highly inefficient. FortisBC, energy for a better BC and a better podcast.
Let's raise a glass or take a shot. Time to raid the mini bar.
I want to raise a glass to the organizers of this year's Vasaki, which is the 25th anniversary. I didn't go. I saw it on TV, though. It looked fabulous. 500,000 people. One scary moment with a scissor lift that hit some wires or something. It is really an incredible political occasion, too. And this time, all the reports noted the tremendous sympathy for the cause of Khalistan because of the shooting of Hardeep Nijjar, which happened earlier this year. But the Vasaki event's a fantastic community event. It's very distinctive in BC, very important politically, and they did a really outstanding job. So congratulations to them. I wish I had been there.
Fantastic.
I'll raise a glass to my friend Dave Teixeira from Port Coquitlam, another Tri-Cities guy. You know, for many years, Dave has been a citizen representative or advocate for a very tragic situation where a family, children were murdered in Merritt some years ago, and the father who murdered his kids continues to show up in review hearings to be let out seeking unsupervised care, or whatever the situation is. Dave goes to those hearings, represents those who have died, and advocates in their memory, and for the mother who was also recently passed away, who had to bear the terrible burden of losing her children. So Dave was in the media recently. I want to acknowledge him for taking on something that matters deeply for not just him, but for a lot of people when victims of crime can't speak for themselves. So, Dave, thank you.
Fantastic.
You're here.
All right. And I will also raise a glass this week. I'm going to raise a glass to former Vice President Al Gore. And I think this will be the only time I raise a glass to anything to do with US politics. But in this case, actually, last week, I was at a dinner for the lunch for the Climate Reality Project, and Al Gore was speaking at it. And the one thing I was listening to him kind of thinking, the one thing I would import from American politics is this fantastic ability politicians there have to take kind of sometimes really lofty ideas and ideals and explain them in such a folksy way. We have it here in Canada, too. And I'm going to say, like, Wab Kanu does it. And I think Doug Ford does it to some degree. But I think Al Gore is just masterful. And to give you an example, I think he had this way of talking about how, you know, youth today are struggling so much with sort of climate anxiety, you know, and he did this like little like, you know, denial is not just a river in Egypt. Despair is not just a tire in the back of my truck. And I can't do a good like kind of like, you know, Southern accent, but it's a beautiful thing to be able to take these concepts and make them feel and can communicate them in a way that voters don't feel condescended to. And Al Gore offers a masterclass in that. So my glass is raised to him. And that is it for us this week at Hotel Pacifico. I want to thank James Moore for joining us today. I want to thank our sponsors, TELUS and Fortis BC. We will see you next week, guests. BC, you can never leave.
Check out time at Hotel Pacifico. We hope you enjoyed your stay.